This is 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick in Washington. In towns and rural communities all over America, patients turn to local hospitals to get their health care. In a lot of cases, these small hospitals might be the only health care facilities within 30 or 40 miles of where people live. But increasingly, corporate hospital systems are merging with and sometimes taking over these medical centers. Now, sometimes that means more resources, more access to services that maybe you couldn't get otherwise. But other times, these takeovers come at a cost. Staff are downsized or see a cut in their pay. Services are actually lost or the quality of those services go down. And in some hospitals, they close down altogether. According to a study issued by the journal Health Affairs, more than 100 rural hospitals in the United States have closed since 2010. Now, there are a lot of factors, including demographics and how much government programs pay, that go into these decisions. But at the end of the day, patients and staff can be the ones who swallow a bitter pill. Tasneem Dilsey is a nurse at Catholic Regional Medical Center in Richland, Washington. Her hospital is affiliated with Providence. That's a healthcare system that owns 27 hospitals across about a half a dozen states. Now, Tasneem tweeted us late last year and asked us to take on the issue of big healthcare as part of our January series on the shows suggested and chosen by you, our listeners. So we decided to take this one up, and Tasneem joins me now from Washington State. Tasneem, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you, and thank you for suggesting this topic for us to cover. I'm glad you did. Let's get into it. Catholic, where you work, Tasneem, was taken over in 2013 by Providence, as I mentioned. What happened when that was going on in the boardrooms among the executives? What happened on the ward where you work?
So I actually started 2 years ago down in the ER. Before I graduated from nursing school, I was working at a clinic affiliated with Cadillac at the time that the acquisition happened. And so it was great to see a boost in the community of support, you know, having money coming in so that we can expand, and ended up adding, you know, four more floors to our hospital and revamping our ICU. But, you know, since then, since that time, you know, a lot has changed, and people are feeling the tensions in the community, and especially around the state, with many hospitals, you know, willing to go on strike to really fight this issue of kind of corporate takeover of small mm-hmm. healthcare systems.
Now, Tasneem, what kind of nursing do you do?
I'm an ER nurse.
ER nurse. Now, you mentioned some improvements, added floors to the hospital, better ICU care. That sounds good. How was patient care affected in the ER where you work?
Over the last, I would say, you know, couple years, we're starting to see higher volumes. You know, we have a couple other hospitals in our area that we're dealing with, you know, possible bankruptcy issues and, you know, kind of waiting for somebody to help them out. And so everybody's kind of funneling over to our facility. We're the largest one in our kind of three-city area here. And so we've been seeing, you know, longer wait times, and like, I don't believe the quality of care has gone down. You know, mm-hmm. as somebody who works there, I recognize the efforts of my team to provide the best quality of care that we can. But, you know, you're under a lot of pressure in the community when everybody looks up to you and has looked up to us as a healthcare provider to them for decades. And now you're facing this issue of, you know, high volumes and what to do with patients. Mm-hmm.
Now, you're the big go-to hospital for the three-city area. Was that always the case, or is this a situation where other hospitals in the three-city area closed, and now it's on you to pick up all the slack now that you've been acquired?
So we've kind of always, I feel like, been kind of the big dog in our area to provide health care. There are two hospitals, one in each of the other cities that I mentioned. They are not closed. They actually merged together. You know, RCCH took them over, but they are smaller hospitals and they don't provide as many of the services that we provide.
What was the promise of the takeover? You know, when this was being negotiated, I know word gets around the hospital really quickly. Nurses talk, doctors talk, everybody talks. But also often the corporate entity sends people in to sort of, you know, talk to staff, assure them maybe that this is going to be good for everyone. Do you remember those conversations, what the promise of this takeover by Providence was going to look like?
Maybe not the like specific topics of conversation, but I do feel like Cadillac, you know, board members felt that Providence and their mission aligned with the services that we are providing and aligned with the goals that we had in mind for our community. And so I think that time it looked really great to be able to partner with an organization that, you know, explains and, you know, states that they have such a high, you know, place such a high value on, you know, patient care and compassion and, you know, how we treat our patients in the community. I think Cadillac really wanted to partner with somebody that had those, you know, same goals in mind.
Now, you mentioned a strike that I think might be larger than just your hospital around your region in Washington. What's the situation?
So we actually had voted to authorize a strike a couple of months ago and ended up coming to agreeing to a contract after a 14-month negotiation period. Hospital up the road from us in Spokane also recently ratified a contract with Providence. And now hospitals in Seattle, particularly Swedish, which is also affiliated with Providence, have actually set strike dates for the end of this month.
Oh, so this strike is... Not resolved, in other words.
Yeah, and over at Swedish, they actually voted to have a strike, and they haven't been able to come to an agreement on a contract with Providence. And so they're actually, you know, they have given their 10-day notice to organize and participate in a strike.
So a strike there is possible. We reached out to Providence for this segment. They let us know that they've resolved the contract negotiations. I assume they're referring to Cadillac maybe and not to Swedish because it sounds like that's still in dispute and they declined to come on today's show to talk about it. But Tesneem, what about you? What about your salary? You doing better now than before?
You know, we were lucky enough to have really great union representatives that bargained long and hard for us the past 14 months. You know, in the past year, we were working without a contract. And so we were lucky to come out strong and to be able to, you know, fight for, you know, good raises over the next, you know, the 3-year lifetime of our new contract. But I think what's really important to us is, you know, those of us that are on the front lines, you know, we want to see these staffing crises addressed. We want to see, you know, our benefits, you know, be able to be affordable. We want to see, you know, fair wages and, you know, better language to address this growing epidemic in this country of workplace violence that we face every day. There's, you know, we got lucky where we, you know, were able to get, you know, our benefits package secured and our, especially our paid time off issues addressed so that we weren't getting that cut even more than the last negotiation around 3 years ago. But, you know, my heart goes out to those nurses over in Seattle that are really fighting for, you know, what we were fighting for this whole 14-month period, and hopefully they'll get it done.
Now, before we take a break, Tesneem, just give me the bottom line on sort of the pluses and the minuses of this takeover, because we're going to talk a lot about this for the rest of the hour, and we're hearing from a lot of people who are involved in healthcare. You said at the top of the show, more floors on the hospital. The ICU is better, okay? So intensive care is better at your hospital. You think the ER and the other wards are providing quality care. Great. You're talking about staffing shortages. You have a contract. But, you know, give me the before and after, sort of whether you think this trend in healthcare from your little patch in the healthcare world is a good thing.
So on one end of the spectrum, you know, we do see, you know, when we affiliate with these larger organizations, there's a big cash flow. And so we're able to expand our hospitals. You know, particularly in my area, Cadillac operates several clinics in all three cities, you know, to provide primary care services, urgent care services, outpatient surgery clinics. So it's great to see those facilities expanded and being able to provide more care and reach, you know, people in this more rural area of the state. But I don't think that we should forget our duty at the end of the day is to our patients. And if we can't take care of our staff, it'll be really difficult to take care of our patients. And so I really think that the focus needs to be on, you know, how can we provide the safest care? And I think that starts with how do you provide, you know, the safest care to your frontline workers, and how do you show that, you know, respect towards them? And I think when we focus so much on the money and, you know, especially, you know, Providence and all these bigger corporate hospitals that, you know, really are servicing their executives quite well, we tend to forget about those that are on the front lines and what they're fighting for every day and who they're fighting for.
Now, Cadillac is one hospital that has expanded, but when one hospital is acquired and it expands, it often means that other clinics or hospitals in the area have been shut down to help lead to that expansion. It's consolidation. And Danielle tweeted this: for-profit corporate hospital systems are the quintessential example of where money and medicine should not marry. These are the sickest and most desperate of patients in rural areas, and most dedicated docs are in rural communities. And Bruce tweeted this: people who choose to live in the rural areas know what that means. Slower to no fire response, police not having the ability to arrive quickly, and healthcare practitioners are going to have less daily experience and little chance to practice on unusual cases. That's rural life. And that's important because so often these consolidations affect healthcare in rural communities. Tasneem Dilsi, nurse at Cadillac Regional Medical Center in Richland, Washington, thank you for sharing your story with us.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Coming up, a lot more. We're going to walk through the trends and the typical hospital takeover. Stay close. I'm Todd Zwillick. It's 1A. Welcome back to 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick. Let's add a few more voices to our conversation on big business, corporate healthcare, and community hospitals across America. Elizabeth Rosenthal is the editor-in-chief of Kaiser Health News and the author of An American Sickness: How Healthcare Became Big Business and How You Can Take It Back. Elizabeth, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Todd.
Mark Holmes is here as well. He's professor at the University of North Carolina and director of the North Carolina Rural Health Research and Policy Analysis Center. Professor Holmes, great to have you.
Thanks for having me, Todd.
And we heard this from Linda, a doctor who emailed, "I've been working as a rheumatologist and I've seen the change in culture of the practice of medicine. As big corporations acquire community hospitals, their focus is much more in the financial aspect rather than the quality of patient care. As physicians, we're forced to see patients in unbelievably short times, like 15 to 20 minutes. And I'm concerned that this would affect the quality of patient care delivered and the training of future doctors in our country." And we got this from Deb on Facebook, who says, "I think that this all improves the standard of care. I live out in the boonies, and now we have access to specialists who come here on rotation. I've also seen improvement in salaries and in the efficiency in lab and other diagnostic services." We want to hear from you, just like Deb and Linda. You can comment on our Facebook page. You can tweet us at 1A. You can always email us 1A@WAMU.org. Elizabeth Rosenthal, how widespread is this phenomenon? How many community hospitals are getting taken over by big companies?
Well, I think it's happening all over the nation, and it's happening not just in rural areas, but it's actually happening in cities, too. I mean, one of the case studies in my book is the Providence Hospital in Portland, where we see the same kind of corporatization. And yes, there are some good things, especially with the physical plant and building and the hardware. But what doctors and nurses complain of and what affects patients is that there's kind of a businessification of this noble pursuit, where what you're told to focus on as a provider is, you know, how are you billing? Could you bill more for that service? Could we increase our RVUs, those payment units that insurers and Medicare use to reimburse? And what tends to happen is that patient bills go up and the time spent with patient goes down. So that's a big problem. Mm.
I want to talk about both of those things, patient bills and time with patients and the quality of work for physicians and nurses and everybody who provides health care. Mm. But before we do that, Elizabeth, I don't know if there's a typical case, but what is the transition typically look like, let's say the first year or two, when a nonprofit hospital or some kind of hospital is bought out, acquired, or otherwise partnered with a big company? Not 5 years down the line, what are the growing pains, the transition look like for the people who get treated there and the people who work there?
Well, the first thing I want to point out that one of your commenters mentioned is these are the big corporations tend to be not for profit as well. So we say, yeah, they're for profit hospital conglomerates. They are mostly not for profit. And that's one thing I think we all need to look at. Do they deserve not for profit status? So anyway, they come in. They have a lot of money. There's a deal made where we make promises. We're going to give you, you know, the newest, greatest cancer fighting radiology machine. We're going to promise we're going to build you some new patient rooms, and they're going to be a lot fancier. Maybe there'll be an urgent care clinic of some sort. And then at first, everyone is excited, for the first year. But then quickly, the kind of shine comes off because the corporate people come in with kind of their clipboards and go, why is it taking so long to see a patient? Why is that scanner that we paid $3 million for underutilized? You should be ordering more scans. Why can't you bill for a level 5 visit? And people who've worked in these systems say, you know, instead of thinking what's the right thing for patients, you'll have someone from corporate come in and go, wow, if you just checked off 2 more boxes, we could have billed for a level 5 visit. And the doctor may go, yeah, but he didn't need a level 5 visit. So there's this tension tends to emerge pretty early on, not universally, because it always depends, of course, on the motivation of the group taking over. But the group taking over, if it's a corporate chain, and you know, it may well have a nice religious name, it's still focused much more on the bottom line than the smaller community hospitals that were founded and remain dedicated to their community. So there is huge tension pretty quickly that, as in my experience, watching a lot of these things happens, just builds and builds and builds.
Interesting picture that you painted there. We didn't buy that big $3 million fancy CT scanner for it just to sit there and look pretty. You need to be billing. Use it for that. That's very interesting. Professor Holmes, University of North Carolina, what factors contribute to a corporate hospital system stepping in? What makes a community hospital attractive to a company, either the hospital itself or factors in the community that make them want to move in?
Well, I think you can separate these into two big buckets. The first would be that the rural hospital offers something valuable to the larger system. And maybe that is a market that's been underutilized, and the ability to move upstream and use that hospital as a market capture mechanism to drive more volume to the larger system. So these might be places where, you know, more affluent, relatively non-competitive structure from the rural hospital side, and so is an attractive as a takeover kind of idea. And the other end of the bucket are rural hospitals that are desperately struggling and are looking for someone, a system to come in and provide much needed support. And that may be a tension, for example, of whether we pursue this acquisition and merge with the larger system, or whether we just can't make a go out of it. Oftentimes, those will be hospitals who have, you know, maybe down to making payroll by a week. Sometimes they're looking at, you know, can we make payroll in the next couple of days? And the acquisition looks much more attractive at that point than closing.
So if your hospital is the type of place that we can spruce up and drive what they call utilization, drive customers and drive revenue, not only are you likely to stay open, but we're likely to make it a lot nicer around here. If you're the kind of hospital that's barely making ends meet, limping along, not a lot of wealthy people in the neighborhood, you might be on the target to be closed as we consolidate this system. Is that a good distillation?
Yeah, and I think the notion of the halo effect of the rural hospital that everyone's known for years becoming acquired and having the logo that we affiliate with, you know, a teaching hospital or a large nationwide system, you know, can all of a sudden inject some new perceived quality into a place that we've known for 30 years and we know everyone that's worked there, but now it's a part of this larger system and so may get some of that, may be able to capture more of that market than they had in the past.
Well, we asked our listeners to share their own experiences of being part of a big healthcare system. Here's what one of you left in our inbox.
Hi, my name is Hannah and I'm calling from Pittsburgh and we are part of a major hospital system. One negative experience that we have encountered is that our daughter, who is a heart transplant recipient, is oftentimes treated as part of a whole community of people who have the same condition that she has and not necessarily treated as an individual patient. Protocol seems to be the thing that trumps everything. It's less about her individual story and her experience and more about the protocol for that medical condition.
Elizabeth, what typically happens to patient care when these acquisitions occur? Every case is different, not only medically, but every hospital is different. Are there certain aspects of care, certain services that are the most likely to be affected? In this case, it was cancer care, pediatric cancer care.
Yeah, it you know, every case is individual, but I think one thing we see is that the corporate partner comes in and says, wants every part of the hospital to be making money. So what's your revenue model? Are you generating revenue? And I've seen in one case, for example, the corporate partner said, you know, the OB unit, it's not generating revenue, so we're just going to close it down. Now, the doctors who practiced there and the nurses went nuts and the community, like, wait a second, this is the only place to have babies within 100 miles. And in that case, they successfully fought back. But in other cases, I've heard, you know, the corporate partner say, eh, we're going to close the ER at night and because it doesn't make money at night. And I'm like, hold on. Does an ER at night have to make money? Is that why it's there? Of course not. But, you know, from a corporate point of view, if it's not bringing in cash, maybe you don't want to keep it open.
Yeah, if it's not bringing in cash. Let's talk about some of the things that do bring in cash. I mean, how do hospitals decide what services to keep? Some services like, you know, cardiac procedures, cardiac cath. I've noticed that in my own sort of just driving around, a lot of hospitals advertise they are the go-to place for your coronary procedure. And I'm guessing that's a high-dollar thing that drives a lot of revenue. But what services, you mentioned the ER, don't drive revenue and are likely to get de-emphasized or cut?
Well, it depends on the local payer mix, as they call it. If you've got a lot of rich people around an ER, you may get a lot of great business if they have bright private insurance. If you have a lot of people who are uninsured, it's not going to generate income. But I think one of the big tensions, which you referred to, is around things like cardiac care and joint replacements, which are big revenue generators for hospitals. And the big parent hospital wants to pull those into the mothership. The local hospital may want to keep them. And that's a point of genuine tension, because I'm not sure every local hospital should be doing those big revenue generators. But it does leave the local hospital kind of stripped down and revenue poor and ever more dependent on the corporation.
And then what about patient access to facilities when they're closed? I mean, let's talk about where the tires hit the road, Elizabeth. If you're in a rural town where you were driving 20 miles to get to the clinic and it's closed, now you're driving 60.
Yeah, we've been following it, Kaiser Health News. We've been following a hospital closure in rural Kansas. We call the series No Mercy for the past year. And it's been fascinating to watch because, yes, some people with cancer care who in need of cancer infusions do now have to travel, far longer to get their infusions, which is hard if you have cancer and you feel debilitated from chemotherapy. On the other hand, we have to remember that a lot of rural hospitals were built 100, 200 years ago, where transportation was really bad, and you couldn't get to your, you know, to your doctor if he or she was 30 miles away. Now that's much easier. So, you know, I think it's going to be interesting to see in the shakeout how rural hospitals redefine themselves to satisfy rural needs in the 21st century. And I really hope that's done according to the healthcare needs, not according to the profit motive.
Now, when it comes to staff like Tasneem, who joined us at the top of the show, we got this from Jim, who says, I work for a for-profit hospital corporation. I used to work for a not-for-profit religious-based hospital organization out of Florida. I would much rather work for the corporate hospital. At least they're upfront about how they run their business, Elizabeth. He says at least it's dollars and cents and they're honest about it.
Yeah, in my book, I say, and I, you know, slightly tongue in cheek, of course, that when you look at Providence, which was the hospital corporation I was looking at, that it's kind of these days an odd mix of Mother Teresa and Goldman Sachs. You know, it does a lot of really good stuff. As a not-for-profit, it helps build hospitals in Haiti, but it's also, you know, investing in a big way in healthcare innovation. And so I do think, as I said before, one of the things we have to look at is many of these huge not-for-profit hospital systems don't pay taxes. Are they doing enough for our communities and our cities to merit that? I mean, that's a big political issue way above my pay grade, but it's a serious issue.
All right, Professor Mark Holmes, Carrie from Kentucky left us a voicemail about her town, her rural town, has been affected by this trend. Listen.
Our Lady of Bellefonte, a nonprofit Catholic hospital that was founded in 1953, got bought last year by Mercy. And they immediately laid off probably about 250 staff. And then yesterday, they announced they'd be closing the hospital, both primary and acute care centers, and they'll be laying off about 1,000 people. It's definitely going to affect a town that's already underserved.
Mark Holmes, laying off 250 people, then laying off 1,000 people. In your research in rural communities, is this a common occurrence?
Well, I think when you're looking at closures, you know, across the country for rural hospitals, one of the key factors is to think about – it's easy for us all to think about the healthcare impact of the hospital. But we also need to think about the economic, which was just alluded to here. You know, hospital is usually one of the top two employers in a rural community, the school being up there usually as the other. And if the typical – this is a larger hospital that's being described. The typical rural hospital has about 300 employees. And so you think about a manufacturing plant closing by 300, that, you know, how devastating that would be for a town, you know, to a typical town. Looking at a 1,200, I think, is what we just – the count we just heard there in terms of layoffs. That's going to have a huge economic impact. Obviously, directly.
Yeah, I mean, during the recession just a few years ago, every time you checked the job trends in this country, almost every sector was down. But healthcare was always the sector that was up. If you were a physician's assistant or a nurse or a nurse practitioner, healthcare was always thriving. But then when that economic reality hits a rural community where 1,250 layoffs, it's a very different story.
Yeah, and the other thing to think about too is the hospital as a magnet or an amenity, and so we spend a lot of time talking about closures. There have been some rural hospital openings, and we looked at two in particular from a couple years ago. And at the ribbon cuttings for both of them, it was being heralded as this is going to help us recruit new retirees to our community, and so viewing the hospital not just as a healthcare provider, but also as a recruitment strategy from an economic development. And, you know, if you're going to build a new manufacturing plant, workers' comp rates are lower if there's emergency room within, you know, a certain number of miles. So there's a lot of impacts just beyond the healthcare and direct economic, but also the notion of the hospital as a magnet for the community.
And a job creator. These are economic drivers in communities. Elizabeth, Jeff emailed this. I go to University of Louisville Teaching Hospital for psychiatric care, and the doctor's visits with a psychiatrist are so short, I wonder if this is because they have to keep up their numbers to compete with the for-profit hospitals and other religious hospital conglomerates in town. Does it have a knock-on effect for other non-corporate hospitals to keep their billing up and their visit rates down so that they can compete on the bottom line?
Well, once again, I'm going to push back. I think the university hospitals are just as corporate as the religious-based hospitals and the for-profit hospitals. I think all hospitals operate very much these days on a business model. And yes, doctors are often told that you have to see X number of patients an hour. Or sometimes what happens, which I think is very insidious, is they're told they're basically paid or given bonuses according to the number of RVUs they generate, meaning the number of procedures they do or the number of patients they see.
Those and billing so codes that they send off to make sure that the hospital stays afloat.
There's pressure to generate money.
All right, Elizabeth, take a pause right there. We're going to have a lot more. That's Elizabeth Rosenthal, Mark Holmes. I'm Todd Zwillick. We'll take a break. It's 1A. Back now to our conversation on corporate hospital systems with Elizabeth Rosenthal of Kaiser Health News. She's also author of An American Sickness, How Healthcare Became Big Business and How You Can Take It Back. Also, Professor Mark Holmes at the University of North Carolina. He's the director of the North Carolina Rural Health Research and Policy Analysis Center. And I want to add one more voice to this conversation. Robert Graybois, he's senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. He's here in the studio with me. Robert, thanks for being here.
Delighted. Thanks.
Well, help me understand the economics of big hospital companies and small community hospitals. What are the big economic factors that drive takeovers?
Sure. First of all, I don't find the distinction between the for-profit and not-for-profit to be particularly meaningful. I think Elizabeth Rosenthal has mentioned a number of the charity hospitals, religious, university. They all kind of behave the same. The fundamental thing is healthcare has become extremely expensive because we're doing a whole lot more than we used to do. There's a whole lot of nostalgia about, well, we founded this little rural hospital back in 1943. Why can't we get back there? Because healthcare has very little in common to what it was back in those days. So it's extremely high tech. It's extremely expensive. There's nothing we're going to do to change that unless we want to deteriorate the quality of care. I would also say that the effect of the consolidations is ambiguous. It helps some communities. It hurts some communities. It hurts and when we say the communities, we do have this ambiguity there between, are we talking about the patients or the employees in the hospitals? Personally, I place much more importance on the patients, of how good is the care. And the employment parts are secondary, I think, to the ultimate mission of medicine. And I do think the fundamental thing of the economics is we do an awful lot, both at the federal and state level, to cause things to be needlessly more expensive. And these are especially hard-hitting in rural areas. Things like regulations that limit the use of telemedicine, direct primary care, that we have certificate of need laws that make it very difficult to open new hospitals, licensure. I can go on. I have a longer list. We can talk about it as you please.
The difference between care improving and the hospital being better for the community, mm-hmm. right, is and I realize I'm distilling this, but is a lot of this dependent on whether you're lucky enough to live next to the hospital that Elizabeth described, the one that gets beefed up, renovated, fancy new machines and lots of great promise versus the one maybe further out in the exurbs that gets ignored or closed down? Is that what governs your experience as a patient of whether this is all a great idea or not?
Well, I think absolutely. I mean, part of my own decisions in life of where to locate has been, is there a hospital nearby that's quality? And the simple fact is, we are a vast country with some vast rural areas, some of which simply cannot sustain you know, the sort of hospital that I want to live next door to, especially out west.
Now, Robert, we heard from a listener who has concerns about a hospital system stepping in where she lives.
Hi, this is Pat from Wilmington, North Carolina. We've had an issue recently where the hospital, the local hospital administration and some of the government officials in our county have secretly been having discussions for quite some time about the sale of our regional hospital. The people in the community are very, very upset. The hospital administration keeps telling us that, no, they're just looking to see what their options are. But from what I've read, every time you sell a local hospital to a larger organization, quality goes down and prices go up. So we're very upset about this.
Is that true? Every time you sell a hospital, quality goes down, prices go up. You also mentioned a lot of community. We have a nostalgia for these community health centers, that they're sort of a grassroots part of the community.
Yeah.
Is that true?
No, absolutely. You could. I certainly can't rattle off names here, but you could find plenty of situations where larger hospitals have taken over rural hospitals, and the quality has gone up, and the finances have done better, and it's been better for the community. Like I said, it's a mixed bag. It depends on, I think one of your guests said it earlier, it's just every case is unique.
Now, I'm sensing some dissonance. I have a question for each of you. Elizabeth, I'll start with you. You know, you have mentioned that when these hospitals get taken over, and often they beef up, they get the fancy machines in, they construct the care profile of the hospital to drive revenue. And you know, we spend so much on healthcare in this country, 19% of the economy, an enormous number. And we were supposed to be finding ways to cut costs, to prevent unnecessary tests, to prevent unnecessary expensive procedures. And in a lot of ways, you guys are describing a trend that's going in the opposite direction. Fancy machine, bill. That's expensive.
Well, I don't think we've managed to figure out how to rationalize costs at all. And yes, some of this speaks to that, where you buy new machines to lure in a hospital, and all of these not-for-profit hospitals. Many of the ones that are acquiring, you know, yes, by definition they don't have profits, but they do have quite good operating surpluses, which they spend. On the other hand, I think one of the things that gets overlooked in this is, you know, and one of the things that was eye-opening for me is when we looked at this rural hospital, Mercy Hospital in Fort Scott, Kansas, that was shut down, their bed census at the time they were shut down was, you know, under 10 beds were typically filled. Most of them were empty. And when we talked to people in the community, like, hey, would you go here for your hip replacement? Many people were like, oh, no, I'm going, you know, to St. Louis. So we do need to rethink rural hospitals. I think the point we came away with after a year is, you know, the answer shouldn't be, oh, just we're going to close them down. We need to think how we can better serve rural health needs with maybe some new construct that's a kind of sort of hospital or is part of a hospital. But there is tremendous disruption in the towns for these kind of very beloved institutions where a lot of people were born and work.
Other models of healthcare, community care clinics and such. Mark Holmes, what about my dissonance that I'm experiencing? The very real complaints about healthcare costs in this country, the drag on the economy, and whether this trend of corporate, whether for-profit or nonprofit acquisition, is driving up costs or helping to control them?
Well, I think you can think of some of the examples that Elizabeth and Robert referred to, but you know, take a hospital that was built 70 years ago for, you know, an average census of 60. Maybe it has two now. You know, building a new kind of provider, and this is where the innovation is really needs to start happening at more speed. But is that, you know, imagine a freestanding emergency center that's next door to an outpatient clinic, you know, a place where the local residents can go for their urgent care, maybe get stabilized, and if they need to be admitted, be transferred to something 20, 30 miles away. That may be a way that looks fancy. It's got a brand new building, but may actually deliver better care at lower cost because you're eliminating 60% of an old physical plant that is inefficient and is just being way underutilized. So there may be ways to, you know, with innovation, to structure these new kinds of providers that actually are more efficient.
Robert Grabois, go ahead.
Yeah, and one problem is we have vested interest, and I don't mean the giant corporate interest necessarily. It can also be the local hospital board and the local politicians, whatever, through all sorts of regulations, all sorts of laws that inhibit exactly the sort of innovation that Dr. Holmes is talking about. I think it was Louisiana just passed a law barring new freestanding emergency rooms in rural areas because of the competition that they might provide to rural hospitals. A lot of what we're talking about, a lot of the questions you were talking about, really is the fundamental core of American healthcare is driven by the way Medicare's reimbursement system is structured. The checkoff boxes, whatever, they all come out of that. Even if you're on a private policy, it's really based upon the way Medicare structures it. Fundamentally, we need to change the way that we reimburse care. We reimburse it in ways that encourage us to spend more and discourage us from doing cost cutting.
Well, Mark, a conversation like this can get very technical very quickly, so let's not go there. But there are some very large programs that people are familiar with, Medicare and Medicaid. Medicaid, extremely important, especially in rural communities, in cities too, frankly, but extremely important in rural communities. What are the big ways that Medicaid policy, the way the government pays these clinics, impacts whether they decide to merge, to conglomerate, or whether a corporation decides they want to take them over?
Well, we start with the fact that Medicaid pays for just over half of births all across the country. And so, you know, looking at OB as a case example, I think, is really useful. Medicaid is often, you know, one of the least profitable payers and, you know, typically is the lowest revenue aside from uninsured and charity care, of course. So, you know, that is ascribed to a major cause of the decline in OB care, as an example. And that Elizabeth referred to, earlier in the program, as these rural hospitals are looking at, we're losing money. What can we do? Well, let's start cutting unprofitable services. Labor and delivery is usually one of the, early candidates because it is poorly reimbursed with higher costs. Now, when that happens, of course, one of the effects of that is try recruiting teachers to your school when you don't have a OB unit in town or maternity care within 30 miles. And so, again, this comes back to the notion of thinking about the healthcare as a broader, the role of the hospital or the healthcare provider in a broader context.
Thinking about our economy holistically, which we so seldom do, even in a topic as broad as healthcare. Well, you mentioned Medicare, Robert. Let's talk about Medicare for All, because Carrie tweeted this. Is there a discussion about how Medicare for All might help rural hospitals stay in business as many people avoid going to the hospital due to the high cost of care in the first place? Elizabeth, what do we know?
Well, yes, we hear in our Bill of the Month series many people who say, I'm too afraid to go to the hospital because I have a high deductible plan and it might be really expensive. So, yes, that could allay some of that problem if we don't have these really high deductibles. But, I'm not sure if that's going to get us far enough, and I'm not sure if whether we go to something like Medicare for All, single payer, or a public option is really a political decision. I do think there are a whole lot of ways we can start to solve this, and where we'll end up should depend on American voters and understanding what the options are and what it will mean for them.
Now, we hear about Medicare for All, Robert Grabois. We hear about public option. We're part of the Obamacare debate. They're now part of the presidential debate. But let's say that Congress in the next 5 years decides to go with a public option. Private insurance still exists, Medicare still exists, but people have an option to buy into a sort of a Medicare plan that they might want to be a part of for a fee. How does that drive what we're talking about and how hospitals can survive in communities?
Yeah, I think the public option is a very oversold idea. We've seen public options in a number of different states, in a number of different arenas in the country, and you basically end up with a couple of different solutions. Maine started a public option. Basically, they spent a fortune on it. No one signed up for it. Washington State is aiming for one, and the discussion has been quite open. What we need to do is subsidize it, so essentially it drives the private ones out, but you're still going to be paying. And I think one of the more interesting ones was Los Angeles has had something like that for years. And it's there. It's not much different from private insurance. It doesn't do much. So I don't see that really as being a particularly interesting proposal.
You don't sound like you're terribly encouraged by the healthcare debate that's going on in front of the country right now, and whether it can allay some of the concerns that a lot of listeners say they have about hospitals closing in their communities.
No, actually, I've spent the last 7 years or so of my career mostly talking about how absolutely uninterested I am in the insurance debate, because we focus on it, whether, and I include in that the Medicare for All idea, public option, the Republicans repeal and replace, the ACA. These things, I think, are mostly moving the furniture around on the deck. They are mostly redistributive in terms of care and money. What we really need to focus on is what is getting in the way of innovation. There are some stunning examples around the world of innovation that can't happen here. And the question is why they can't.
Let's give the last word to Laura, who wrote on Facebook this opinion: corporate-owned, for-profit healthcare is immoral, to say the least, making money hand over fist off the sick and dying. The medical-industrial complex is killing this country. Laura, there is a debate on in front of the country right now. It's been going on for years, and it will continue, and I have a feeling that you're going to be a part of it. I want to thank my guests for being part of this very complicated and difficult discussion of hospitals and rural health clinics, city health clinics, too, all across America. Robert Grabois is Senior Research Fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Thank you for being here.
Thanks so much.
Mark Holmes is the Director of the North Carolina Rural Health Research and Policy Analysis Center at the University of North Carolina. Mark, thanks to you.
Great talking with y'all.
And Elizabeth Rosenthal, editor-in-chief of the great Kaiser Health News. She's also author of An American Sickness, How Healthcare Became Big Business, and How You Can Take It Back. Elizabeth, thanks to you.
Thanks for having me.
Well, this show was produced by Arfi Getty. To learn more about her and the rest of our staff, check out the website, the1a.org. And remember, you will find the 1A podcast wherever you get your podcasts. It's a great way to catch up on the shows and the guests that you might have missed during the week. And if you give us a review, that's great. It'll help people find us. We would appreciate it. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington. It's distributed by NPR. Thanks so much for being with us. I'm Todd Zwillick. It's 1A.